today. From video work meetings to virtual pub quizzes and live stream fitness classes, how we are adjusting to a new socially distanced life. It's 9 a.m, a typical day in this new normal, and we're starting with some exercise for the kids.
Right, it's time for Joe Wicks.
Come on, Joe, let's do this. Right.
Live streamed, of course.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to day number one.
Is everyone ready?
Theo, are you ready?
So we're
going to
go on our first exercise.
Spider-Man.
Then at 9:30, log on to Zoom for a Today in Focus team meeting.
Nice. Nice haircut, Josh.
My girlfriend did it.
Followed by a Google Hangout, then a lunchtime break and a quick FaceTime with my mum.
Hi, Mum.
How are you?
Yeah, good. How are you?
Circle the hips forward.
A dance class also on Zoom for producer Hannah Moore.
Hey, mummy, you need to learn these moves.
And a pub quiz online with mates for our colleague, Rachel Humphreys.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome, and all those who are smart enough to have no gender, welcome to Amy's birthday quiz.
Back to Hannah's for a big birthday, her 30th, celebrated with a house party.
Cheers from Denmark.
I'm talking about the app, of course. And then an even bigger birthday, this time for me. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, how the coronavirus crisis is driving a revolution in technology. Alex Hearn, UK technology editor at The Guardian. This period has been very busy for our health and science editors and for our political team, but also for you, because we're all turning to technology to cope with this new quarantine. Tell me what people are doing.
People are replacing going outside with the internet, essentially, which is, for me, not unusual. That's basically been my life since I was about 12 years old. But everyone else is rapidly learning what you can do if you're a massive nerd these days. You can do fitness programs from YouTube live streams.
It's Vogue, wrap around and push.
So watch me now. You're going to step back with your right leg first.
You can take virtual lessons in cocktail making or crocheting.
Is that what you do?
I mean, I did one of those two things. Or you could just hang out with people. Something that I think none of us ever really thought we'd see is a bunch of us and our friends sat in front of a webcam with a drink in our hands, talking about how the day went. Getting some of that human contact is so important. And it turns out that we've had all of this technology for years, and we have, partially out of an ingrained belief that kind of in person is better, refused to use it as much as we're now all being forced to.
Coronavirus has stopped us seeing our friends and family, and it's cut off many of us from other communities too. How is technology helping to bridge the gap?
Everyone is trying to replicate as much of their old lives as possible. So right back from when the Catholic Church decided to suspend masses in northern Italy, religious authorities have been trying to work out how to do without in-person services.
Welcome to the YouTube channel for the Cathedral of St John the Baptist in Norwich.
I'm exchanging the pulpit for Facebook, and I'm exchanging the communion table for my kitchen table.
My dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For a very special bar mitzvah boy, Jojo Hershkowitz.
For the wider community. May God bless you and your families during this difficult time of uncertainty.
Although in the UK we've not actually banned funerals, they're one of the exceptions to the ban on group gatherings. Even if it's technically allowed, for obvious reasons, people might not feel comfortable with heading to a large group of people. And so they can sit at home and watch the service from isolation.
Arguably, the biggest shift that needs technology, if it's going to be successful, is this huge move towards working from home. Even the Prime Minister Boris Johnson after he tested positive for COVID-19.
I've developed mild symptoms of the coronavirus, that's to say.
That means all those daily meetings face-to-face are gone. Instead, companies are using software like Microsoft Teams or Google Hangout or FaceTime or Skype, or increasingly, a technology I'd never even heard of before, Zoom, which has seen a huge, perhaps temporary, spike in its valuation.
Yeah, it has. It's been used a lot and it's being used more every day. Zoom is a video chat service, essentially. They have worked very hard on their technology to make it so that you can click one link and be in a video conference without needing to install software, without needing to make a user account. But yeah, and so Zoom has this freemium tier, which is a 40-minute capped group conversation. The idea is obviously that if you like using it and use it for your business, you end up paying. But honestly, I think for a lot of people, a 40-minute capped conversation on any meeting is fantastic. A lot of people have discussed the fact that they wish that that was just a standard for all meetings everywhere. It ends at 40 minutes, all the participants are thrown out, and if you've not finished, fine.
I think that could make work a lot more efficient. But look, it's not all positive. You've been writing about Zoom bombers? What are they?
Zoom bombers. They are trolls. They are a particular breed of troll, a subspecies. One of the things that you can do with Zoom and with a lot of video conferencing software is you can set up public groups. The problem with that sort of thing is if that link gets out in public, anyone with that link can join it. And then there are other services on Zoom, like the ability to share your screen, that can also be used to wreak havoc once you're in someone else's meeting. And so you end up with people joining public hangouts and screen sharing violent pornography, or people joining public hangouts and shouting racial slurs at the participants until the entire thing has to be shut down. It's unpleasant. I think it's about learning what privacy settings are and the fact that there are idiots online.
Well, I was going to say, what can people do to safeguard themselves?
A big one is if you are having a completely public meeting, don't post the link on social media. If you're having a completely public meeting that you do want strangers to come into, then you need to do things like disable auto join so that anyone trying to join has to be approved by you. You want to do things like disable screen sharing so that the people who do join cannot then broadcast what they want.
I did notice that the cabinet was meeting by Zoom. I wonder if they knew about what the privacy settings were.
That I would love to know. That's not the sort of thing that we could tell from the screenshots, I'm afraid.
I mean, the upside to all of this is that people are going to realise, are realising, that a video conference is just as doable as, say, for example, getting on a plane and going to a single meeting. That could be great when we're thinking about carbon reduction in the future. But there are some jobs for which technology is not as helpful and where working from home is not as easy, and they tend to be lower income jobs.
They do, and we're seeing a huge divide in who is able to carry on working and who's not. Thankfully, the UK government's policy around this has been a lot better than many, and so if your job cannot be done from home and your employer furloughs you, you still get paid, which is hugely important economically. If your job can't be reduced to moving words around on a computer screen, then all of this technology is only going to go so far. I have been impressed by the ingenuity of a lot of people. You've had dance coaches have taken their classes online.
Sorry guys, technology is not my thing, but we figured that out. So from the top we go 6, 7, and...
But there's no amount of technology that can let a construction crew work from home. They have to be out there.
We've talked about Zoom, and I know that that's being used socially as well as in an office setting. But which other companies are doing well out of this?
It's both big names and small. One of the ones that has had the most meteoric rise recently is an app called House Party. It's a group chat app that lets up to 8 people have a conversation. It had a core use of US college students before all of this.
I've downloaded it. And I'm ready to use it. But when my friends were talking about using it yesterday, they were saying weird things about how other people can come into your house or join your party. What's that about?
Well, one of the things about the app is it does try to replicate that Hangout feel, right? So what that means is it sort of announces when someone's online, the rooms default to quite an open state. The idea of the app is that theoretically you should be able to open it, see which of your friends are hanging out, and just dive in and join them. If you want to have a much narrower focus chat, you know, invite three people and have a conversation with them, a house party does leave you slightly open to a gatecrasher.
I don't want to be gatecrashed online in my house.
Well, I'm afraid online gatecrashing is a very real thing.
Now we have this bizarre situation in which rumours started to spread claiming that House Party might be dodgy, that it could even hack into your phone. And then House Party itself did a weird tweet saying it was a smear campaign and they give $1 million to anyone who told them where it originated. What's going on?
The simple answer is we're all getting a bit overexcited. House Party's in that weird situation where millions of people have installed it in the last couple of weeks. And that means that almost anything that they start looking for coincidentally will show up shortly after they installed House Party. The state of affairs that we seem to be in right now with this hacking rumour is that lots and lots of people suffer hacking attacks in any given week. And this week, almost all of them have also installed House Party. So if you're looking for something that you did in the last week that might have caused it, it's very easy to settle on that. The more interesting question is whether House Party's accusation is true. The company clearly has someone in mind. It would be wrong of us to speculate who they might be thinking is spreading this, but they are serious about it. You know, that $1 million bounty for evidence is not idle talk. Every cybersecurity expert I've spoken to about this is clear that House Party looks secure and safe from anything that you can see externally. The only thing at the outside edge of possibility would be if users had reused a password on House Party on other apps, and then House Party had been hacked itself. That password reuse could be dangerous. But again, there's no evidence that House Party has been hacked. So all of the evidence suggests that House Party is safe, and that provided you're okay with the user interface risk of accidentally stumbling into a room that you're not invited into, it should be fine.
Alex, often when we speak to you, it's about where people behave badly online. We've spoken about people trolling or bullying online. But in a weird way, this terrible crisis is kind of unifying people.
You know, I think there's definitely a sense of Blitz spirit, right? We are all in this together. We will get through it. And it really helps to know that the hardships that you're suffering are the same as the hardships that everyone else is suffering.
Wash your hands and stay indoors. Thank you, baked potato. Only go to grocery stores. Thank you, baked potato.
You know all the pubs and clubs and that shutting? Well, Mr. Weatherspoons reckons he's going to keep his open.
No!
Yeah!
Imagine no. There's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
For social media, in some ways, tonally, this has taken us back a decade to a world where everyone on social media is on social media all the time. Jokes and memes are spreading and evolving faster than they ever have before, and they're going more mainstream at the same time. There's been an absolutely fantastic trend of recutting artworks and album covers to put all of the participants 2 meters apart to make sure they are socially distanced. So you get Abbey Road with the Beatles spread much further out. You get, in fact, someone did it with all of the Beatles front covers except for Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which...
That would have been difficult.
Yeah, they kind of threw up their hands and said, that would just take too much time with Photoshop.
Let me ask you about FOMO, fear of missing out, because do you think that now there's nowhere for any of us to go? FOMO's a thing of the past.
I wish. If anything, the opposite. I've been surprised both in my own life and from speaking to friends about it, how alive FOMO still is. It makes sense when you think about it, right? Normally in your life, you have an excuse, a white lie to tell yourself about your FOMO. If you're not at that party, well, maybe you couldn't make it. Maybe they didn't have room. Maybe now it's like, oh, they're, you know, anyone can come. Anyone in the world can come to these Skype drinks. and you still weren't invited? That's personal. And JOMO is the opposite of FOMO. JOMO is the joy of missing out. JOMO is that feeling you get when you have texted a friend and told them that you won't be coming to their house party tonight, and you are sat in your pants watching really bad television and just actually...
Do you have to be in your pants?
I feel more joyful the more schlubby I am. I don't know. Maybe you get dressed up and you're sat in your Saturday best watching really crappy television and feeling absolutely great about your life.
Speaking of sitting at home in your pants, I mean, Netflix and other streaming services must be doing well.
They're actually doing concerningly well. Streaming bandwidth on Netflix and on YouTube and on Amazon Prime has gone up so much that first the European Union had to ask those companies to reduce the quality of their videos. And then a lot of them have now voluntarily rolled it out worldwide. The amount of extra TV that we're all watching now that we're stuck in every evening would, if they hadn't reduced the quality, have led to about a 25% increase in the evening peak, the bandwidth that all of Britain's internet service providers are having to send out to homes nationwide. They could probably have coped with that, but it would have been dicey. And so the video providers reduced the quality of their videos, which managed to just cancel out the increase in use.
Stay with us to hear Alex talk about how governments are using technology through this crisis. But first, we'd love to know what you think of this show. Do leave us a review if you get a chance. But if it's not too much to ask, we would also like to get your views regarding the wider world of podcasts. Your opinions will be extremely valuable to us and will be used to help shape the future of Guardian Podcasts. As a thank you for your contribution, there will be a chance for you to win a John Lewis voucher worth £250. We won't take any personal details other than an email address if you'd like to be entered into the prize draw. If you would like to help us, you can access the survey on guardiansurveys.com/podcast, or alternatively, click on the link to the survey in the notes for this episode. We are, of course, interested in what you think wherever you are in the world, but unfortunately, this survey only works if you're in the UK. Thanks. So all of that is about individuals' use of technology, but this has become incredibly important for governments too. Can you give us some examples of how they're using technology to collect information on the coronavirus spread?
In the UK, I can tell you the two things that I know the government has done recently, one of which is using mobile phone networks to get information out, and one of which is getting information from mobile phone networks. The government sent a request to the mobile phone companies asking for aggregated anonymous data so that they could see patterns of usage. The idea there is, if you've given advice about social distancing, you need to know if it's being followed. You don't necessarily need to do sort of a snooping style tracking everyone individually, but what you do need to do is say, okay, well, the mobile phone mast in the middle of London's West End normally has this many connections on a Saturday night. On this Saturday night, how many connections did it have? Has it gone down by 25%, 50%, 75%? The answer to that question is really important because it tells you whether voluntary social distancing is working. And given voluntary social distancing is over, I think we can guess what the data told the government. At the other end, we all, I think, got it. The text that the government sent out telling us that there were new rules and you had to stay in your home.
That just went to everyone, yeah?
That went to everyone.
I was convinced that they recognised I'd just been for a run.
No, the reason why everyone got it in such staggered amounts was because the UK government doesn't actually have an emergency alerting system. Our colleague Jim Waterson broke the news that it had advised itself that it should build it and then never got round to doing it. So instead it had to enlist the carriers to send it out. Speaking to one network, they had 46 million devices connected, and they were sending messages at a rate of 1,000 a second from 8 a.m. till 8:30 p.m. on that day. And that's one network, and there's four major networks in the UK. It was just a huge, huge thing to get done. Other countries have taken different approaches. Israel did ask for individual location data and got it. The first that anyone in Israel knew about that was when the government started sending out text messages to people saying, you have recently been near someone who has COVID-19, you need to self-isolate, which was done by tracking both the carrier and the bypasser and just seeing if their phone's location data was in the same place. Technology has been important in that contact tracing approach. So Singapore, for instance, has brought out an app that uses Bluetooth so that your phone can tell what other phones it's connected to in any given day. And then if you are found to have COVID-19, you can give that log over to the government and the government can go and track down the owners of those phones and isolate them.
I mean, it sounds quite Orwellian.
It is quite Orwellian, even more Orwellian. If your phone has been in contact with the phone of someone with COVID-19, you can be isolated without anyone even needing to see you. You can get a text and the text can say, do not leave your house for a week. You will be required to send a picture of yourself in your house, geotagged to your house's location, twice a day, and you will receive a £6,000 fine if you fail to do this. You also need to send us your temperature every day. And that is essentially Singapore's regime right now. It's not focused on freedom, but it is, by all accounts, extremely effective at preventing the spread of COVID-19. And that's the sort of really difficult trade-off that we're going to have a conversation about having here once we lift the social isolation.
Really effective without locking down every single person in the country.
That's the trade-off here. You either lock down the country, or best case scenario is you lock down only the people with the coronavirus, and you need to find them, and you need to find them before they infect others.
Are there concerns about privacy with all of this?
Endless concerns. Every intelligence agency would love the ability to know where every single citizen, resident and visitor in a nation was, but we don't let them. And historically, we viewed this as a clear line. One of the concerns is that once that line is crossed, it may be hard to reverse it. A lot of privacy activists have looked at what Israel has done with fear. But at the same time, other privacy activists have viewed this as a chance to have that conversation, particularly in America, where existing privacy rules are very, very weak. There's been a counterintuitive trend on the part of privacy activists to go, okay, we need to write a law that allows this to happen in an explicitly time-limited way. And so it also sets baselines for what should be allowed in normal times, because currently in America, if you as a business can get hold of someone's personal information, they probably gave it away by not reading the terms and conditions, and you can probably do whatever you want with it.
Alex, we've been under lockdown for more than a week, and as you say, we've already seen this huge shift in the way that people are behaving online. We've talked about some big innovations in the way we work, study, and also the data the government collects on us, all enabled by technology. After coronavirus, what of these changes do you think will remain?
The big one is the proportion of Brits who work remotely is never going back to normal. If you are someone who struggles to pay for childcare in your normal life, and if you're someone who's found that you can actually handle working in the same house as your children, then it's going to be really hard for your employer to force you back into the office when they've seen you doing a perfectly good job for weeks or months during coronavirus. I hope that we're going to see a new blossoming of a lot of long-distance friendships. The number of people, at least in my life, who I saw once or twice a year when I made it to their city, who I'm now seeing every week, and it's great, is making me question why it took me so long to do that before.
What about house party? Do you think we're going to be ditching trips to the pub?
You know what? I already can't wait to get back to the pub, actually. I can't imagine that virtual happy hours will really stick around. They are fine, but they feel a bit forced. I think, again, it's like the Blitz, right? There are some huge changes in British society that happened in World War II. But at the same time, we weren't eating sausages made out of sawdust forever.
And what about for you, Alex? What's changed for you that you're going to keep?
The thing I'll keep up is my webcam Dungeons & Dragons sessions. It's really nice to hang out with nerds from around the world and just get our geek on.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me remotely.
That was Alex Hearn, who is writing all about this. Do keep up on the website. There are also really interesting stories at theguardian.com around the role of police in enforcing the lockdown, plans to rescue Britain stranded abroad, questions around testing and healthcare resources, and a really interesting long read on the race to develop a vaccine. That's it for today. My thanks to Alex Hearn. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Ian Chambers. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. I hope you are keeping well, sending love from all of us at Today in Focus. We'll be back tomorrow.